A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Your lovely local country pub is threatened with closure. Should you buy it? Where next for house prices? We have the latest indications. And growing your own vegetables, is it really worth the bother? Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast on personal finance and investing. I'm James Pickford, Deputy Editor of FT Money, and I'll be giving you this week's money news in downloadable form. Most of us have experienced the pleasures of a country pub, the roaring fire, the benches overlooking the village green, the Sunday roast washed down with a pint of well-kept ale. But there's a problem. More and more of them are closing down or being turned into homes or restaurants or coffee shops. Instead of retreating to their homes, though, local residents are increasingly taking matters into their own hands by buying up the pub and running it for themselves. Alan Livesey, a writer on the FT's Lex column, has been doing some frontline reporting for FT Money on Britain's country pub revolution, and he's here to tell us what he found. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Hi, James.
Why are people willing to take on the risk of owning their local pub, and how are they raising money for it?
I think that when it's a particularly in country villages where the pub may be the only amenity really there. There may not be any shops. The post office may have closed. And there's a lovely pub where walkers stop by, where the entire village gets together. They'll miss it, they feel, and they don't want to see it be the pub either disappear and become flats or house or just turn into a Costa coffee shop.
Yes. And is it generally led by an entrepreneur or a philanthropist, or is it more common to see groups of people doing this?
I think it starts with one or two individuals who are customers. They don't want to see the pub shut. Then they'll do a whip round and usually bring in more investors, usually locals. I think on the premise that there might be an effect to property prices in the area.
Ah, yes. But it's presumably hard to say exactly what kind of effect on property prices.
I mean, I came across one estate agent telling me he had a case where a couple wanted to move from their village because their pub had closed up in the Midlands. So I do get that. I do get the sense that there is a concern about that. On the other hand, some estate agents will say it does depend. I mean, it depends if the thing's in a national park, if it's in a beautiful location, the pub may not be the only thing that's holding up property prices.
And when people decide to do this, are they standing behind the bar pulling pints, or are they getting other people to do that? Are they hands-off owners?
Well, they're hands-on owners in the sense that they have to manage it. So one of the pubs I looked at, the George, I can assure you that the chairman is involved all the time, and he has run companies. And
the George in where?
In Burpham, in near Arundel, down in Sussex. Yes. And that is a case where they had to get very involved. In other cases, they do get involved because they want to see what it's going to be like. And that was the case of another pub, Seven Stars in Dinton in Buckinghamshire. And they got involved and very quickly realized you need professional management. And they got out and hired that person.
Yeah, it's a tough business, isn't it? I thought also that pubs were quite hard to make money out of. What sort of returns are these people telling you they're making, if any?
Well, one of the reasons they get in is often the landlord or previous owner has really struggled. It may be that it was tied to a brewery. It may have been owned by a landlord of pubs, and the rent sometimes just keeps going up. A new landlord comes in, there's better footfall, better trade, and they raise the rent again, and it becomes a Sisyphean task to be able to keep this thing going, and they give up. That's when the locals realize there's no one else, they've got to step in. Is it easy? No. But what I'm hearing from the at least the people I interviewed is they have made a decent return.
And what happens if you get into a sort of bidding war with a pub company? Are you always going to lose out in that case?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, there is the Localism Act of 2011, which allows a village or a council, I should say, to turn something into an asset of community value, list it. All that does is give you the time to stop any bidding process on the other side and allow the locals, if they choose to do so, to put together a bid. They're given 6 months. If it, you know, if the price is just too high, I don't, you know, it's just not going to, they're not going to win, are they? But I would say that probably you win if you have enough passion and interest and can show.
Yes, you have your opportunity.
You have your opportunity.
Thanks very much indeed, Alan. And you can read more about taking over your local pub in this weekend's FT Money cover feature. We're going to stay with the theme of house prices now in light of some interesting research looking at the performance of prices in 20 cities across the UK. Richard Donnell, Research Director at housing market analyst HomeTrack, which did the analysis, is here to talk to us about it. Richard, thanks for coming in. Your research has uncovered some interesting developments, particularly when you look at London and the South East versus the rest of the country. What have you found?
We've been running this index for cities. We found that London house price inflation is running at plus 1% in nominal terms. That's the lowest for 8 years. And we've also found that house prices within London are falling in 40% of postcodes, whilst they're still rising in 60. Move further afield into big regional cities like Manchester and Birmingham places, and there's no signs of a slowdown in house price growth. Affordability still looks attractive. And house prices are rising at more than 7% per annum in five cities.
A real gulf. What, just to ask initially, what are your figures based on? Are they actual sales? Are they asking prices right now?
They're actual sales and they're valuations conducted by surveyors as part of the mortgage lending process. We tend to find those two numbers are very closely related, and it just makes the sample size bigger as we build out the index.
Yeah, and you know, people did start talking about London falling prices 3 years ago, but that was very much in the context of the most expensive luxury properties, properties in Mayfair, Kensington, those sorts of places. Where else in London are we now seeing prices come off?
Well, yeah, prices are starting to fall further afield. I mean, the index we run for London City looks at London's housing market area. People, when they decide where to live, if they work in London, they don't think about the administrative boundary stops at a certain point. So our index does stretch into the commuter land, the core commuter areas. Yeah. And so we're finding prices falling in places like out towards Guildford, out in places like Gerrard's Cross, as well as sort of those outer suburban commuter locations, like, you know, including places like Raynes Park. So prices are starting to soften in a whole range of places right across the market.
And having seen that this softening taking place, do you predict that it will continue? Do you have anything to say about what will happen in future?
I think over the rest of 2018, I think we're going to see the percentage of markets registering price falls is probably going to keep on rising. It's not going to expand everywhere. But I think it's all about these markets where pricing has just got out of kilter with what buyers who prepare to live in that market want to pay or can afford to pay. And I think, you know, most of it is concentrated, say, in the higher value areas outside London, in the sort of inner zones within central London. So I'd expect over the course of this year, there will be some more price falls coming through. We're probably going to see our headline index move to sort of zero or low falls by the middle of the year. And it's just all part and parcel of prices realigning to what demand that's in the market is prepared to pay today.
And you mentioned Birmingham, Manchester, as part of a different story of growth. Which are the cities seeing the strongest growth in your ranking at the moment?
Well, it's Edinburgh number one, followed by...
And what are we looking at there in terms
of... It's about 7.5% year on year. I mean, the Scottish housing market took a lot much longer to get going. They had the independence referendum that sort of delayed things picking up. Then they introduced this new land and buildings tax, a new type of stamp duty in Scotland that also had an impact on the market. But finally, things now sort of seem to be improving. I guess the one non-bright spot in Scotland is Aberdeen, where prices are falling because of the oil price impact on demand locally. So we've actually seen house prices come off 15% in Aberdeen in the last 2 years or so. So it's a real example of if you shock a local economy, you're going to have an impact on property prices.
And just finally, when are you looking at particularly places like Liverpool, Manchester, Birmingham, is it possible to discern how much of the growth is driven by owner-occupiers or by buy-to-let investors?
I think investors are a part of the market. I mean, they've been a feature of the market for the last 15 years or so. At a national level, investors account for about 30% of sales, 20 to 30% of sales. That's buying. It's actually more like 20%, 20 to 25% of sales. That's a mixture of cash investors and mortgaged investors. That number's cooled a little bit just recently. So the bulk of demand in these markets really is owner-occupiers feeling more confident, having not taken advantage of lower interest rates, lower mortgage rates. And off the back of unemployment falling, they're coming into the market. You know, transaction volumes aren't racing away, but there's enough transaction activity to keep prices moving well above the level of earnings growth.
Mortgages are affordable too.
Yep. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Richard Donald. You can read more about his research in this weekend's FT Money. And that includes a list of London postcode areas where prices are falling. Now, at FT Money, we've always tried to serve our readers' interests by addressing the big questions about finance. Should you transfer out of your pension? Which equity fund is best for your ISA? But I can't recall us ever tackling the question of whether you should grow your own vegetables. That's all changed this week because James Max, author of our column Rich People's Problems, has identified a trend for posh people to plant their own potatoes, parsnips and peas. James, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Now, rich people growing their own vegetables, is this actually a thing?
This is a thing. This is a very, very exciting thing. This is something that, if you're not doing it, you are missing out. And if you have thought about it, get on with it. And there are some real benefits. This is no longer a thing about, oh, we haven't got any money, so we must grow our own because otherwise we're all going to starve. We're in the middle of a world war. It's not that kind of thing. This thing is all about provenance. It's about finding things to do with your time. It's about having stuff to discuss with your neighbours. And it's about discovering things that, because we've all been so stupid, by not going to local purveyors of fine, decent produce. So we all go to the supermarket, we've bought things out of packets, and it's become bland, boring and dull. So that means that you can't get a lot of the stuff that you can now grow. So when it comes to specialist tomatoes, heritage vegetables, all sorts of tastes and flavors and colors and sights and sounds and all that sort of stuff, you can't go and get it. So therefore, the only way is to do it yourself, and you might enjoy it, and you might save some money. And to be honest, it's not about the money anyway. It's about taste and flavour and excitement.
Okay, so I was going to say there's an opportunity cost for people.
Well, there is. It means you can't sit in front of the telly and be boring.
So not about saving money. Now, the only thing is, I love a homegrown French bean as much as the next man, but there's a problem in that growing them yourself, they all arrive roughly the same time over a two or three week period, and when you're just deluged with these things, you have this glut. How do you get round that?
Well, look, there are several things. First of all, I think the glut is not quite as narrow a window. I mean, if you plant carefully, you can have stuff from May until almost beginning of November. So you can have some really long months of providing proper stuff if you plan it properly. The second point is that there's no problem with freezing, particularly runner beans. If you freeze a runner bean, blanch it, freeze it, you can do all sorts of stuff with them with the fruit glut. So, of course, I would love to have fresh fruit all the time and never have to go to a shop. That's not possible. But what you can do is twofold. First of all, if you freeze berries and you freeze them well, you can use them in crumbles, you can use them in all sorts of cooking where it doesn't matter that they're not fresh. And you can make jam. I love making jam. It's the best thing ever. And you can give it to friends. You can get people involved with it. It tastes so much better. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Am I sounding enthused?
You are.
You've sold me.
But then I have to confess at this point as a certain disclosure, which is that I was this weekend digging over my allotments in North London that I share with a friend. Now, but if I'm to compete with the most fashionable allotment, what should I be planting this year?
Well, look, there are some things that I think we should all grow because they do taste better fresh. And I think you've identified beans, but there are so many different kinds of beans. So by all means, have the runner bean. But for example, you try and find a fresh bellotti bean in any shop, anywhere, and I'll give you a prize because you can't. But fresh bellotti beans are incredible and you can grow them. And then you can get the heritage ones, the purple ones, which cost a fortune if you do find them. And generally, they're not available either. So pick things which are interesting and variable, but then also go hunting for the things that you've never heard of. For example, like the asparagus pea. This thing is delicious. I grew some last year. They're delicious.
So it's a pea or a pea? What does it look like?
Well, it's probably more of a bean, to be honest. They're brilliant.
And you mentioned something called a cucumelon.
Now this is this year's excitement. I've not grown them before. I have, however, tasted them before. And they're like, they are a little bit cucumbery, but with a sort of limey, sort of slightly sour twist. Mm. So they're not a fruit per se, but they're great in salads. So I thought, well, I've got to grow something new, something I've never grown before. This is it. It's all about the cucumelon this year.
Fantastic. Well, I'm enthused. Perhaps you can return to us in a few months with some samples of your produce.
Well, I'll bring some jam and we can have a jam off.
Thank you there to James Max, FT Money's official horny-handed son of toil. That's all from The Money Show this week. If you've got a story you'd like the FT Money team to follow up or a question to pose to our team of financial experts, get in touch. Email us money@ft.com. Tweet us at FT Money or comment on our articles online at ft.com/money. We'll be back next Thursday at the usual time. Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.